You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, June 29th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress, the editor of Think Progress Justice, on the ending of this Supreme Court term. Some of the major decisions. Just what's going on with Anthony Kennedy? Also on the program today, primary wins for some Bernie-crats, others not. Zephyr Teachout. She's going to be my next congresswoman. Knock on wood. Also, two transgender women will be running for Congress for the first time ever in our nation's history. Meanwhile, Istanbul terror attacks appears to be ISIS. We'll have more on that later. Speaking of terror attacks, Tyson, Ditka, and China. A little preview of the Republican National Convention. Tyson, Ditka, China. Teachers unions launch a frontal attack on hedge funders and their charters. And legalized marijuana, recreational use marijuana, will be on the ballot in California in the fall. I don't know if we're ever going to see a larger rout than what we're going to see in California come this November. All that and more on today's program. The Benghazi, oh, I should also say, of course, yes, the Benghazi, the 80th Benghazi report has been issued. And apparently we are back to where we were sometime around the second Republican debate, the second presidential debate in 2012, where Mitt Romney is begging Candy Crowley to, I don't know, to give President Obama some type of demerit for not acknowledging that that he was trying to fabricate something on Benghazi. I want you people just to contemplate this, and maybe we should wait. We have some Benghazi sound, right? Well, let's talk about this right now. Okay. The Benghazi report comes out. This is the Trey Gowdy version. And in this report, the administration is chastised. It's an 800-page report. Incidentally, Trey Gowdy says you should read it. Now, I'm old enough to remember when conservatives had their underwear in bunches because the Affordable Care Act was longer than 100 pages. Like, that was literally what I heard from conservatives 6 years ago, was we should have no law that is longer than 100 pages. Yet, the seventh or eighth Benghazi report is 800 pages long. I want people to remember this, okay? I'm not diminishing the deaths of four people. And I'm not diminishing the deaths of an ambassador and some security guards, basically. But it is now June of 2016. We are 4 years out from the attack in Benghazi. which took place on the same day when there were like seven other attacks or protests, either on U.S. consulates or in other locations in other countries around that that region because of a video. We are 4 years out, and they've just released a seventh report that is 800 pages long. In 2005, was there an ongoing investigation about the failures of 9/11? I mean, was there even one in 2004? I mean, this is just absurd. This is beyond absurd. Now, it would be that much more bothersome for me if it wasn't something that I felt. I mean, it's a huge waste of taxpayer dollars. But in the final analysis, I mean, relatively speaking, you know, millions of dollars is not that big in terms of our budget. And it the thing I do appreciate, it's like this, I don't know, it's like one of those like childhood fables, like, right, where some like a spirit demon leads kids down some like eternal wormhole and they never come back. Some scary thing like that. Here is Trump spokeswoman Katrina Pearson reacting to Trump's reaction about Brexit. Here she is. Look at the power of Benghazi.
With the criticism of how Donald Trump spent the days while the rest of us have been watching the big board sagging after the Brexit vote, Donald Trump was doing business in Scotland, opening a golf course. And when asked about the impact of Brexit, which he said was a good thing, affecting so many people in America, you know, losing their 401ks before their very eyes, his response was instead about it would be good for his business, that people would come to Turnberry because the pound was sagging, even though people in England would be suffering under a sagging pound. And this is how Secretary Clinton decided to use it in a campaign ad. Have a listen.
Every president is tested by world events, but Donald Trump thinks about how his golf resort can profit from them.
When the pound goes down, more people are coming to Turnberry.
So this is a tough thing to navigate, suggesting that Brexit and the fallout was actually good for business. How do you accommodate for this?
Well, it's not really a tough thing to navigate, Ashley, and perhaps Mr. Trump could have gone out and blamed Brexit on a video that never really existed, and maybe the media would have been okay with that response. Mr. Trump answered like a businessman, and he was talking about Scotland.
Katrina, what did that mean?
When the attack on the consulate of Benghazi occurred, Hillary Clinton went out and lied to the American public and blamed it on a video. That is something that was very serious because we lost
the video that did exist, though. That was a film that did exist.
But it wasn't the cause. It wasn't the cause. It was.
I mean, there you have it. I mean, this is just, it's stunning. I'm surprised she didn't say, well, at least he didn't, at least Brexit didn't say that it was part Native American. Like, I mean, how much, what is it? It's fascinating to me. And here's the thing, is that all of the feedback that Pearson and Trump got from that appearance, I can assure you, was positive. Like, you made that right. You got the Benghazi in there. And so, I mean, I'm both just sort of disgusted and amazed, and also very appreciative that these people are so deluded. It really is. It's
Mitt Romney was panting.
Panting.
Like, Candy, Terrorists of the Rose Garden.
Did you hear what he said? Tell everybody. Tell everybody the truth. There was no video.
Oh, my God. I'm about to have a human orgasm. President Obama just terrorism. And then she was like, he in fact did say it. He went, no.
That's right. That's what it was. That's right. The controversy 4 years ago was that he didn't say it was an act of terror. Or he only said it 36 hours later, not 35 minutes later. Right, Candy? Right? Isn't this how I'm going to win the election? They're insane.
And Obama said, he goes, well, I did say it in the Rose Garden. And then Candy goes, he did, in fact, say. And then Romney's face, it was almost like a kid that was getting driven to ice cream and then like misbehaved. And the parents at the last minute were like, you know what? You're actually not getting ice cream. And
that's right.
Like, no.
We're going to get ice cream. You, Mitt, however, you didn't clean up your room. So only your brothers will be getting ice cream.
Candy.
But the Rose Garden doesn't count. But you've got to say it in the West Wing.
But he's an adopted Negro brother. So unfair.
Folks,
put down father again.
Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers. They've eliminated the commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small, how did they do that, size box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and a soft, breathable sheets. Mattresses can cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost $500 for a twin-size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, $950 for a king. But not only that, not only have they cut out, like you go into one of those sleep stores, this is the part that I find is amazing. This didn't happen before. You go into one of those mattress stores, you go to lie down on the mattress, and they look at you as if there's something wrong with you. Like, you could do it for 60 seconds, but if you stay there for, like, longer than 60 seconds, which is generally, now granted, when I go to sleep now, I only sleep in about 180-second increments because of my children. But most people sleep for longer than that. But in a mattress store, you can't even try out the mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. They offer free delivery, free returns, but you got 100 nights on the bed. That's over 3 months to test to see if you love it. And if you don't love it, they pick it up and they refund everything. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. It's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada, ladies and gentlemen. Canada. Even Canada.
Hey.
Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Now, they'll send it to Canada, but it is made in America. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/majority and using the offer code majority. Terms and conditions apply. That's Casper, like the ghost. Does anybody know that reference, or am I dating myself?
No, I think everybody knows. Okay. Casper.
Casper.com/majority. Use the offer code majority. All right, folks, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ian Millhiser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and editor of Think Progress Justice. Ian, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
We had our annual, dump of Supreme Court cases, resolutions for the term, and some very big cases. Let's just go over them briefly. I mean, I think people know, sure. We've talked about them a little bit, but I want to also look at them in the context of the fact that Scalia wasn't there. Let's start with inarguably the biggest case would be the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstadt. Tell us what was involved in this case, because this is going to have I think, massive implications for women all across the country, in fact. And I feel like we've already seen it even in the days following the ruling.
Yeah, so this is a crushing blow for abortion opponents. This was, they had built the strategy over the course of about the last decade, where in 2007, there was an opinion which suggested that if there is medical uncertainty as to what does and does not affect women's health, then the court would be very deferential into how legislatures try to sort through that uncertainty. So what a lot of states started doing is they started enacting sham health laws, where if you kind of squinted at them, they looked like health laws on the surface, but they really didn't do anything to benefit women's health. What they did do is they made it really, really hard to operate an abortion clinic, and often very, very expensive to do so. Texas enacted a pretty aggressive version of these sham health laws, and then they went to a very conservative court of appeals, the United States Court of Appeals of the Fifth Circuit, which didn't just uphold this sham health law, but it wrote an opinion that sort of adopted every trope and every theory that anti-abortion groups had come up with to try to maximize the ability of states to restrict abortion. So that's what happened before it got to the Supreme Court. And what happened is, not only did the Supreme Court say these sham health laws aren't allowed, but because the Fifth Circuit gave such a comprehensive litany of here's all the things that the anti-abortion groups want, the Supreme Court had to go not entirely line by line through it, but go through a lot of those things and shoot them all down. And the punchline is that the right to choose is now on stronger footing than it has been on in a decade. All of the tactics, all of the most, what seemed like the most viable tactics used by anti-abortion groups have now been destroyed by the Supreme Court. This isn't necessarily a return to the world of Roe v. Wade, which called for a much more robust right to choose, but it is a very serious blow to groups that have been trying to restrict abortion for a very long time.
And all right, so just outline that for people, because I think people think that we still live in a Roe v. world, a Roe v. Wade world, but in fact we live in more of a Casey world, right? I mean, just tell people what I mean when I say that.
Yeah. So Roe v. Wade was 1973, and it held that there is a fundamental right, which is the strongest level of protection the Constitution can give, protecting a woman's right to an abortion. There were some caveats to it. It said that over time, as the pregnancy develops, the state gains more of an interest in regulating it. But at least in the first trimester, there was really maximal protection for a woman's right to choose an abortion. The Reagan administration, which was anti-abortion, came up with a standard called undue burden. And the whole point of the undue burden standard is it was supposed to be weaker, much weaker, than the standard announced in Roe v. Wade, and would afford much less protection to women who seek to have an abortion. And in 1992, in the Casey opinion, the Supreme Court adopted the Reagan administration standard. So they said that states could regulate abortions, they could restrict abortions, so long as they didn't do so in some way that imposed an undue burden on a significant number of women's ability to access abortion. And that's the world that we've lived in since 1992. What a lot of your listeners are probably noticing is that these two words, undue burden, you're probably wondering what that means, because they aren't particularly specific words.
Right.
And that's kind of the point. You know, what has happened in the world since we went from fundamental right to undue burden is that it meant that conservative courts had a great deal of leeway to say that undue burden meant pretty much whatever they wanted it to mean. And in the case of the Fifth Circuit, it meant that they could reduce the right to choose down to pretty, you know, something pretty close to nothingness. And now the Supreme Court, really for the first time in a very long time, has come back in this whole woman's health decision and says, no, undue burden actually means something. Like, there is a real right here. At the very least, what a state cannot do is pass a law that's based on a lie. They cannot say, well, since we can't outright forbid abortion, we're going to try to get rid of it by putting more and more burdensome restrictions on abortion clinics and then pretending like they're health laws.
Yes. That's the key point here, is that we now have basically a standard where they say you have to prove. I mean, there's two aspects to the undue burden, right? It's the imposition that it puts on women, but it's also the justification, right? And it's now the justification part that needs to be, you need to bring evidence, right? You can't be just an assertion, I guess.
Right. And I mean, what the Texas tapped into, I mean, they tapped into something very clever here, which is that, you know, abortion clinics are regulated just like all medical providers are regulated, and they should be regulated. I mean, you know, there's regulations in, you know, governing all doctors, dealing with like the credentials that a doctor has to have, dealing with the procedures they have to use to keep their patients safe, dealing with disclosure. You know, these are all things that are a normal and appropriate part of regulating the medical practice that we want. What Texas did is it took its legitimate power to make sure that that the practice of medicine is done safely and tried to use it to do something else. So, like, you know, for example, one of the regulations that they passed in this law that was just struck down requires every abortion clinic to comply with the standards that apply to ambulatory surgical centers, which, you know, as the name implies, these are places where major surgeries take place.
Right.
And on the surface, you know, that might sound like a perfectly sensible health regulation. You know, some abortions are considered a form of surgery. But when you break it down, it actually makes no sense. First of all, many abortions are what's called medication abortions. They're induced with a pill or a series of pills. They aren't, you know, there's no surgery at all, and so there's no reason to have a surgical facility in order to give a woman a pill. Even abortions that are done surgically, you know, a big chunk of the ambulatory surgical center regulations are concerned with creating a sterile environment for surgery. A sterile environment is very important for open surgeries, where you actually break the skin,
right,
and you could potentially introduce germs into the body's inner cavity. But abortions are typically performed through the vagina, and the vagina is not itself sterile. So it doesn't make sense to impose these very tight regulations even on surgical abortions, because, you know, the reason for the regulations do not exist in the context of abortion. You know, so this is just a long way of saying that what they were doing here is they were imposing really expensive requirements on these clinics that didn't do a thing that was related to women's actual health.
I mean, there's a quality to this where it just sounds like the Supreme Court said, you know what? Enough. Clown time is over. I mean, we gave you an inch, you took a mile, and now we're going to shut the whole thing down, essentially.
Yeah, no, I know. And clown time is over is really a good way to put it. I mean, this could have been a different case, you know, especially if Scalia was still alive, if Texas had just been honest. You know, if Texas had said, you know, we don't think there should be a right to choose, we think it should be limited, and, like, you know, and that had been their theory, like, let's just overrule Roe outright. I don't know that they would have gotten Kennedy, because that's been tried before, and Kennedy didn't sign
right
on to it. But I don't think you would have seen, like, the swell of anger from many of the justices that you saw in this case, because they felt they were being lied to.
Interesting.
You know, it's one it's one thing to have an open conversation about whether the Constitution protects abortion or not. It's another thing to do the backhanded thing that Texas did here.
And we should say that on Tuesday of this week, the Supreme Court refused to hear cases from Mississippi and Wisconsin to revive similar requirements. They also turned away the challenge to Washington state regulations that prohibit pharmacists from refusing to fill emergency contraceptives because of religious objections. So there's a real quality of, like, you know, we're putting this to bed for a while, ladies and gentlemen. Like, this is, we now want something that is going to be to have some durability. Before we talk about Kennedy in this, because I don't think Kennedy's was that surprising in this, let's turn to Fisher versus UT, which is the affirmative action case. Because, I mean, and we've talked a little bit on the program about the immigration case. That doesn't seem to be as much creating laws as much as it was like a punt in some respects. But this Fisher versus Texas, this has been kicking around for a while. And in 2012, yep. My understanding is it was reported that Kennedy was poised to write a sweeping opinion about this case when it came from the court before, and it would have basically shut down affirmative action. Tell us about the result in this case and what has changed. Like, what's going on with Kennedy? You know, there's obviously the absence of Scalia in terms of a vote. Is Scalia's absence also impacting Kennedy in some way, as just like there's just a different perspective on where the court is headed now or what? I mean, talk about that in that context of that case.
Yeah, I mean, Fisher, I mean, next to the death of Scalia, was the single biggest surprise of the term. Fisher, you know, the court was already down one justice because Scalia is no longer there. Fisher was actually down two because Justice Elena Kagan was recused, and that means you had a conservative majority. You had a seven-justice court with four conservatives. And Kennedy, who is the only one of the conservatives who has shown any possibility of less than maximalist conservatism on issues of race, has been very opposed to affirmative action in the past. Fisher is actually the first time in his career on the Supreme Court where he has voted to uphold an affirmative action plan. Everyone has their theory on why Kennedy flipped here. I don't know that I have a fully fleshed out theory, but I do think the history here is very interesting, which is that Fisher was before the court, like you said, in 2012. Kennedy looked Kennedy, it's been reported, had voted to strike down the affirmative action plan originally in 2012. And Justice Sotomayor wrote a really scathing dissent responding to Kennedy. Joan Biskupic, who's a very fine Supreme Court reporter, has reported that after Sotomayor circulated her dissent, Justice Breyer sort of played good cop to Sotomayor's bad cop and brokered a deal with Kennedy where they wound up punting the case for a few years. It came back up to the Supreme Court this year. And, you know, no one thought that Kennedy had really changed his mind. They thought that he just decided to punt. But lo and behold, he really did change his mind and voted to uphold the program. I don't know if that's because of the absence of Scalia. I don't know if it's because the combination of, you know, Sotomayor's hard play and Breyer's softer play really did move him. But it was, you know, the most surprising vote that a justice cast this term was Kennedy's vote to save affirmative action.
Give us a sense, Ian, because I'm sure that you know people. At the very least, I know that you know people who know clerks, right, on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I mean, how far-fetched is it? Like, when you tell me, like, that Breyer went and brokered this deal, essentially, that, you know, changed Kennedy's mind, at least to going from striking down to punting, is it possible that just, like, I mean, I have no sense of this, but like the bully, you know, in your homeroom class, transferred to a different school, and all of a sudden you just become, you just, you know, flower as a different person, essentially. Like, I mean, is there a possibility that Kenny was just like, you know, I mean, I don't know if he's like, would be conscious of something like this, but just, there's just more room for him to sort of be, I don't know, affirmative action curious, now that he doesn't have a Scalia there to, like, you know, be, you know, I don't know, sitting there pounding his fist into his hand, just looking at him like, don't screw me over. I mean, give us a sense of how possible that is, or is that just sort of like fantastical?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are several things that may have contributed to Kennedy's vote. And it's important to keep in mind, Fisher was a narrow opinion. So, like, it's not like he, you know, he handed down this sweeping leftist, you know, black nationalist triumph. You know, he said that in very limited circumstances, colleges can have affirmative action programs if they are super, super careful. So it's not a sweeping victory for affirmative action, but it is a victory.
Right.
And I mean, I think several things happen. I mean, one is that if you look at Justice Kennedy's past opinions, he has always kept a little bit of distance from the extraordinary hard line, colorblind, like we must close our eyes to the fact that race exists. And if you acknowledge that race is a thing, you are a racist views of someone like Chief Justice Roberts. So Kennedy had a tendency, like in the Parents Involved case, where Roberts literally struck down a public school's desegregation plan. Roberts wrote the opinion. He said the way to eliminate discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, as if that's all it took and no one had ever figured it out.
Right.
Kennedy agreed with the outcome in that case, but he wrote a separate opinion that was less hardline. You know, his dissent in Grutter, which was the big affirmative action case from 2003, you know, did what the conservatives want to do, but was less hardline than some of the other opinions. So that has been the ground that Kennedy has carved out. He's always been a theoretical moderate, but his vote always went to the conservatives. So a practical conservative and a theoretical moderate. And I think two things might have changed. One is that he might have been turned off by the hardliners. But the other is, I think the presence of Sonia Sotomayor may have made a difference, because now he has a colleague who could speak from experience about what it's like on the other side. And, you know, between the two of those things, he may have turned his theoretical moderation into something real.
I mean, that concept, just like, the fact that you would have this is the thing I think is so hard for people to sort of wrap. Maybe it's just hard for me to wrap my arms around, but just the idea that, like, okay, Sotomayor is chosen, and that because Kennedy has the opportunity to actually talk to someone who is not, you know, who is not basically sitting in the lounge at the Federalist Society or whatever it is, you know, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I had no idea these dynamics exist. And then the law of the land has changed. I mean, let me ask it this way, because years ago when I had spent my 1 year in law school, I had read a book about comparing Frankfurter and Brandeis. And Frankfurter was the pariah, and I think it was Brandeis was the parvenu. And the idea was that wherever Brandeis was, he always wanted a foot in the other camp that he was in. So when he was in the World Zionist Congress, he always kept a foot outside to be more American than his compatriots. And when he was on the court, he wanted to keep an outsider foot there so that he would approach the court as if he was a Jew who at that time was, you know, sort of subject to a significant amount of anti-Semitism and quotas and whatnot. And I wonder if Kennedy, when he perceives himself as a moderate, is that a function of just like where the people on his right are? In other words, if you don't have Scalia there pulling a ballast there, does he just drift towards the left a little bit because he's just creating a certain distance always, a certain arm's length from where that those opinions are going to be? Or, I mean, does that make any sense?
So, I mean, I have a few thoughts about that. I mean, one is that what I think makes Kennedy different from the other conservatives on the bench, if you attend Federalist Society events, the product that the Federalist Society is selling is a notion that legal principles essentially exist in some sort of platonic world of being separate from the way the world actually works. So, like, what a judge should do is they should sit down with legal documents, they should sit down with the text of the law, the text of precedents, and they should sit down with no knowledge of their experience of how the world actually works and come to the right answer. And that is not how Kennedy operates. I mean, Kennedy, sometimes the better, sometimes the worse, really does draw upon how he perceives the world in deciding cases.
Right. There's no corruption, perception of corruption if people give money, right? That type of thing. That's an occasion where he's wrong, I guess, on Citizens United. But
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of things I don't like about Kennedy's approach, but, like, it is a different approach from, say, Justice Thomas's approach to the law. So you take that, and then the other thing that I think you could take, I mean, you see it most starkly in the context of gay rights. When Justice Lewis Powell sat on the court and the court decided Bowers v. Hardwick, which was a 5-4 decision upholding sodomy bans, Justice Powell was the fifth vote for the majority in Bowers. And at one point he was asked why he voted the way he did. And I believe this was a direct quote. He said, well, you know, I just don't think I've ever met a homosexual. As it turns out, he actually had several clerks who were gay, one of whom, Paul Smith, went on to argue Lawrence v. Texas, which overruled Bowers.
Hmm.
But setting that aside, you know, the difference between Powell, who was also a moderate conservative, and Kennedy, is that by the time Kennedy came around and was deciding gay rights cases, gay people started to come out. And so gay people were no longer a theoretical construct to Justice Kennedy. Some of them were his friends. They were his former clerks. They were some of his former colleagues. And that gave him an understanding of not just what it meant to be gay, but of what he shares with gay people that Justice Powell did not have. And in the same way, I think that the presence of Justice Sotomayor could have influenced Justice Kennedy, because the idea of someone like Justice Sotomayor, who benefited from affirmative action, because she benefited from affirmative action, she went on to Princeton, where she graduated second in her class, graduated summa cum laude, won all kinds of awards, and went on to go to the Yale Law School and eventually become a Supreme Court justice. But the presence of someone like that in his life, I think, may have impacted him in the same way that the presence of gay people led to the difference between Justice Kennedy's opinions on gay rights and Justice Powell's votes on gay rights.
That's fascinating. Ian, I know you're running out of time here, but just briefly, out of the remaining cases that we heard from this week, Voisin, which upheld the Federal Gun Control Act regarding misdemeanor domestic violence, the U.S. versus Texas on immigration, which basically put a hold on DAPA and DACA, what are there any other cases that we should be paying attention to in terms of how they were resolved at the end of this year?
Well, I mean, I will, put another finger real quick on the Texas immigration case, partially because it's such a tragedy that
Right. There's
now close to 5 million people who were going to have the opportunity to come out of the shadows and live full lives. And that's what the Supreme, or at least what four justices decided not to give them. I think it's also a reminder, the New York Times had a piece, Politico had a piece, the Washington Post had a piece about how, hey, like the Supreme Court's, it's the end of conservatism in the Supreme Court. And, the court we have now is certainly a lot better than the court that we had 3 years ago. But
or 6 months ago, for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's still a lot of terrible things that they can do. There's still a lot of terrible things that they are doing. And if that last seat is filled with someone, you know, along the veins of a Roberts or Alito or a Thomas, then they're going to start to do, you know, it's going to be just as bad or worse,
right,
than it was for a very long time.
I mean, the death of Scalia is just one of those things that it's like where it's hard to recall in modern history where the death of one person that was not brought about by military conflict in some way is going to positively impact people's lives, as far as I can tell, in so many different ways. I mean, I just noticed that also the Supreme Court refused to reopen Friedrichs. So regardless of what happens, with the election, public sector unions are going to exist for at least the foreseeable future. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it, and I know that you squeeze this in, and I really do appreciate it.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. The number 646-257-3920. When we do, we've got some great sound for you. Just a couple of house cleaning notes, messages. We'll be here tomorrow. Friday, we will be pre-taping with Cliff Schechter. So, but we will run on Friday. And then next week, and I should say Steve Cook, Michael will be talking to Steve Cook about what's taking place in Turkey. Next week, we will have pre-records. And we will be on tech/vacation days. The Friday, we'll definitely have something for members, and we will maybe have something for your freebies. But July 4th, we will take off because it's so difficult to operate a microphone and to barbecue simultaneously. Very dangerous to attempt something like that. Folks, let me remind you, this program, next week we've got some great interviews. Pamela Lewis, she is a New York-based writer, teacher, and has written a book about her experience teaching teaching basically as a black person and teaching black students. Andrew Basevich will be with us. We have Catherine Eden. It's a good week of interviews. And just a reminder that we can do this on a daily basis, even on vacation, even when we on vacation. I mean, this is the thing that's amazing. First of all, there's no other show that when they go on vacation, do you get a daily show? It just doesn't happen. We rarely do best ofs. I mean, we do that, I guess, at the end of the year, but that's like the best of the years. That's not like a repeat. And nevertheless, even if we did a couple of shows a week, Dayenu, am I right? Do you know what that means, Matt? Matt has no idea. Matt,
that's just like, oh, Matt, there's Jewish fellas. It's just a whole other cultural experience. Just there's so many.
That's right.
Y'all fellas know Jerry Seinfeld?
This is for Matt. This is like what it's like for Anthony Kennedy to meet someone who's Puerto Rican, who is actually like a peer.
So is usury actually part of your religion, or is it something that grew up alongside it?
On day one, when Matt came in for his interview, you could see the look on his face. He was just looking for the horns.
He was.
He was just looking for the horns. He was just like, he was doing a lot of like this, like just trying to look over my head. There was a woman I went to college with who was from West Virginia who grew up thinking Jews had horns.
And made it into Connecticut College without getting dissuaded of that at any point.
It's not horns, it's antlers, right?
Oh, no, that's what they teach you where you came from.
It's antlers.
Oh, I see. So that's a little more benign.
I just
that
remember
explains it.
Like one time very early on where she was, you know, we were all, y'all show up, you're freshmen, everybody drinks too much. She was drunk and she was laughing uncontrollably, like just so relieved, I think, that the Jews didn't have horns.
I just had no, because I knew I had to study with y'all.
No, she from West Virginia. I didn't know. That was not her accent.
Oh, what was the accent then? What's the West Virginia accent?
It was a little bit more like sort of, you know, third generation hillbilly. I don't even know if I could do it.
I know y'all didn't have horns.
There was a little bit of that.
It's a real relief that I sit next to you in class that you ain't going to try to suck my Christian blood.
No, she was probably 18, not 65.
That doesn't make any difference. All sounds
without
the same.
Teeth, but
Matt comes in. Matt was just like, yeah, you all. I mean, I don't judge. I don't judge the antlers, fellas.
That's right.
No, I'm more cosmopolitan than a lot of other people.
You have to wear a hat with that?
Did she not have television? Or like, I don't understand.
She just, I mean, it's not like she was, I think by the time she was in like late high school, she, you know, had heard rumors that that Jews didn't have horns.
In my county, there is problem. Ain't that problem?
But I don't think,
not that I think television would be the only way to see that that's a ridiculous thing to think, but...
Well, that was
you would
before.
Think that you
well, first
would
of all, it was
have
just,
seen someone with horns.
Were there
cable,
Jews there?
Cable was not that. There was no cable television at that time. I mean, cable had just been rolled out probably a couple years before. It probably was not in where she lived.
Wait,
were there like less Jewy Jews than you at Connecticut College?
Cable was not ubiquitous. I mean, I had cable like 1 or 2 years before I went to, I think, 2 or 3. But it was not, you know, it was like literally wired. And you had like an A-B switch, and you would hit these buttons. I mean, cable was, it was pretty rudimentary.
And she might not have had that.
And it's possible that she would not have had that. Yeah. She was just, it was like, there's a rumor going around that Jews don't have horns. Is that true?
That's the best thing. I heard that y'all might not actually have horns.
And she was just laughing uncontrollably with glee that it wasn't
it
true.
It was just, I've had that experience multiple times, actually, in my life.
Pardon me?
I've had that experience multiple times, like, where I've had in-laws who were, like, just, there was just, like, some palpable sense of relief of, like, clearing the air. Like, you don't celebrate Christmas, do you? No.
Oh my god, that's totally Christmas. It's amazing.
Matt came in,
out of it, but I've never heard the horns or the antlers thing.
Well, yeah, you're from Pittsburgh.
Your parents didn't raise you properly.
But not only that, if someone would have told me that when I was 6, I would have been like, nope.
In Pittsburgh, nope. It was like, look. All the antler and horn stuff is nonsense.
Kelly,
the bottom line is that they're parasitic bloodsuckers who take their money and own a property, okay?
That's
we don't
need
to believe in any type of fairy tales to understand that the Jews are controlling and destroying the world.
Right. The important thing
to keep sweetheart?
In mind is their control of the media.
Look,
that's the only thing.
They don't need to have horns to run our news
program. That I was aware that I had read in print somewhere negative about Jews.
What were you reading?
The media thing is
some protocol.
I mean, let's face it, the media thing is pretty true. I mean,
well, exactly. No, Jews run the media.
Well, exactly.
Well, no, I mean, I had there. It wasn't the internet. I mean, I was reading magazines. I read a ton of magazines.
Jews owned all the magazines back then.
Well, no. I mean, there would be like references to the stereotype that Jews ran the media.
Matt came in. He's like, y'all fellas don't celebrate Christmas. Don't worry. I don't either because God is dead. I'm a rebel.
All right. Look, we shouldn't be giving out all this great, Jew myth-busting material.
And perpetuation.
And perpetuation.
That's the great thing about this show.
We'll both simultaneously enlighten and also muddy the waters. That's what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to muddy the waters a little bit. Folks, like I say, to maintain Jewish control of the media, we need your help. So please become a member today of the Majority Report. You will, of course, be written. Your name will go down on the Western Wall. We have a segment there where we write it in eternity. And when we do ultimately reach the day of reckoning, you will join us
It's our version of Mormonism.
All the bones will come up and something will happen. But at the very least, between now and then, we will continue the show with your support. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. You can always check out the sponsorships that we have by going to majority.fm/support our sponsors. We keep that fairly updated, and we're going to do a better job with that in the future. But I don't know when the future will come. All right, let's take a quick break, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.